Welcome, I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. Coming up, right after the news, it's Philosophy Talk. What's the topic this week, Ken?
The philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche, especially his views about the origins of morality, John.
Ah, that explains the music. Nietzsche on morality. Didn't Nietzsche think that morality was something of a confidence game, where kind of naturally weak people like you entrap natural aristocrats like myself into being nice to them, otherwise we'll feel guilty?
Something like that, John. He did think it was important that the strong not be taken in by the morality of the weak. That's true.
Now, you don't really believe that stuff about morality being only for the weak, do you, Ken?
I don't know, but what if I said I did, John?
Well, I'd be very careful when I was around you.
Oh, John, stay with us as we examine Nietzsche's provocative views about the source of morality. First, the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
We're coming to you from the wonderful studios of KALW Information Radio in San Francisco. But we like to imagine ourselves sitting on the grass or at Philosopher's Corner, a shady oasis on the campus of Stanford University. There's plenty of room, so sit right down and join us.
Today, we'll be examining some of the views of the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, especially his views about the origin of morality.
Well, Friedrich Nietzsche was born just about 100 years before I was born. He was born in 1844, and he was young enough to be influenced by Darwin, and by the time he died, he stopped writing long before he died because he had a mental illness, he had produced works that have been extraordinarily influential, on the 20th century.
Supposedly, he influenced the Nazis. You know,
well, that's often said, but that's probably a misreading of Nietzsche. At least that's what I've been told.
Yeah, me too. So why don't we get to the correct reading of Nietzsche? Let's think about Nietzsche's views about the nature of morality a little bit.
Why not? You're more of a scholar than I am. What are the kind of views about the origins of morality that philosophers have held? Where do we fit Nietzsche into this group?
Well, there's the one I learned at my mother's knee and in Sunday school, that God dictates the laws of morality, sort of the divine commandment theory of morality.
Your mother had talking knees, Ken?
She talked a lot.
That's pretty impressive. The divine command. I don't think that was Nietzsche. Nietzsche's famous for saying God is dead, and I suppose God could have first issued his divine commands and then died, but that doesn't sound like the Nietzsche I read.
No, that's not the Nietzsche you read. There's also the, there's sort of the divine command made eminent. That's kind of Kant's view.
Famous or something?
No. instead of transcendent.
I see.
The commandments of morality are the commandments of reason. They come from our own rationality.
This is your man Kant.
Yeah, that's my man Kant.
And I bet he ends up finding the Ten Commandments right there in reason, huh?
Yeah. That's not a Nietzschean view either, obviously.
Well, how about what's the next view?
Yeah, there's your man Hume, David Hume, that British philosopher who's kind of a naturalist about morality.
Okay, David,
somehow rooted in human nature.
David Hume, 18th century philosopher. We have this natural sympathy that's just part of nature and morality. Realities build on that.
Yeah.
Nietzsche was a Darwinian, and he was definitely not a supernaturalist, so maybe he was a naturalist.
Yeah, it could be. I learned in graduate school, I have to say, that Nietzsche was actually a moral skeptic, that he didn't really believe there were moral facts. I remember taking this course at the University of Chicago, but that might not be right. But in a little bit, Brian Leiter will join us, and he'll straighten us all out.
Before we get the expert opinion on Nietzsche, we're going to learn a little about the New Jersey opinion on Nietzsche.
Yeah.
I think part of it is expert, and part of it is not so expert. Our roving philosophical reporter didn't have to go to New Jersey. She just got on the phone and called Princeton and turned on her TV and tuned in to an episode of The Sopranos.
What did you just say? Death just shows the ultimate absurdity of life.
What is this? Are you trying to get me to lose my temper? Because I'm about to put you through that goddamn window.
See? That's what I mean. Life is absurd.
Don't say that! God forgive you!
There is no God.
Hey!
In the second season of The Sopranos, A.J. Soprano, an awkward, sullen teenager, discovers existential philosophy, and he tells his parents that he won't be getting confirmed in the Catholic Church, or any church, anytime soon.
Now, what's going on with you?
Nothing.
What? You know, that no God shit, that upsets your mother very much.
It's not no God. It's just God is dead.
Who said that?
Nietzsche. He's a 19th century philosopher from Germany. Anyway, that's why I'm not getting confirmed.
Enough with that shit, all right? Your confirmation's coming up this weekend, and you are getting confirmed.
There is a sense in which Nietzsche voices a complaint that you are more likely to hear from adolescents than from mature grown-ups.
Alexander Nehamas is a professor of the humanities at Princeton University. He once called Nietzsche, or Nietzsche, as A.J. Soprano calls him, a philosopher of adolescence.
The traditional adolescent complaint that, you know, I am not like you, let me be who I am. And to some extent, I think Nietzsche is voicing that kind of complaint about contemporary culture and contemporary civilization. He believes that morality, in particular Christian morality, of which he is a great enemy, is designed precisely to make everyone act the same way as everyone else. He believes that a few people, at least, not only do not need these rules, the rules of Christian morality, but that living by those rules deprives them of their most valuable aspect, of their individuality, of their creativity, if you want.
The Nietzschean hero, or Superman, is constantly recreating himself, questioning everything, being an artist of life. Back to The Sopranos.
You're up next.
Nah, I just want to watch.
Sometimes you got to do things you don't want to.
Why?
Because your parents say so, and it's part of your tradition.
That's not what Nietzsche says.
Oh, Nietzsche.
You might not describe A.J. Soprano as an artist of life, but he's got a touch of the Superman to him. He's breaking the rules, refusing convention. Still, he's got an attitude problem. Nietzsche did believe that life is ultimately absurd, but for him, that was cause for celebration, for art, creativity, not sullen teenagerly angst. Again, Alexander Nehamas.
No rule by which we live, none, and he is very clear about that. No moral rule, no religious rule, no social rule, no legal rule is unbreakable. Who you are is not necessarily what you have been made to be by your society, your family, your parents, your religion, your schooling, your social class. It can always be something else.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy. Hey, Ken, if the Sopranos can have an HBO series and talk about Nietzsche, couldn't we have an HBO program? Maybe the Philosophers? I could be the star and you could be featured.
Yeah, but John, you have the looks for radio, so I don't
know. Well, yeah,
anyway,
true, yeah.
Joining us to talk about Nietzsche is Brian Leiter. Professor Leiter teaches at the University of Texas at Austin, where he holds the Joseph D. Jamail Centennial Chair in Law. He is also, by the way, a professor of philosophy. He has written widely on both jurisprudence and on Nietzsche, including the book Nietzsche on Morality, published by Routledge in 2002. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Brian.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Brian. John Perry here.
Hi, John. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good, but I'm a little confused about your man Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche was dismissive of what he called the herd morality, and he seemed to think most of us belong to that. He sounds to me like a little bit of a moral skeptic, and my friends in literature put him right up there with Foucault in kind of deconstructing everything that we ordinarily believe in. But I know in your book, you defend the idea that Nietzsche was really a naturalist. So tell us about Nietzsche and your take on Nietzsche on morality.
Sure. Well, naturalism, of course, is a term that means a lot of different things in philosophy, as both you and Ken know. But why don't we start with Hume, whom you mentioned in your introductory remarks. Hume has this idea, which I think he shares with Nietzsche, that a lot of what we ordinarily believe can't be rationally explained or rationally justified, and therefore we have to find some other way to explain why do we believe these things? Why do we believe in the morality we believe in if it has no rational foundation? Why do we believe in causation if there's no rational foundation for our beliefs in causation? So both Hume and Nietzsche, I think, are responding to this same problem. But Hume comes at it from a slightly different perspective than Nietzsche, it's fair to say. Hume assumes that we have certain natural dispositions that lead us to believe the conventional moral beliefs that we're all familiar with, these natural dispositions of sympathy, as it were.
Yeah.
Nietzsche, on the other hand, has a psychological story about why we accept the morality we accept, and that psychological story tends to undermine or debunk the status of our moral commitments and our moral beliefs.
So, Brian, to see if this is right, we could say they're both naturalists in the sense that they think if there's anything to morality, whatever there is to morality, it's got to be found in nature. No supernatural deliverance from God or some mysterious reason. It's got to be found right there in nature. It's just that they find different things. And Hume's is a little bit more fitting with the traditional morality, and Nietzsche's is a little bit more of a story about why we believe it without necessarily making it true.
Right.
Is that about right?
Nietzsche's aim is to undermine morality. I mean, his most famous book on the subject, The Genealogy of Morality, is called The Polemic. And it's a polemic whose aim is to tell us things about how we arrived at our moral beliefs. But the things he's trying to tell us are supposed to shake us out of our conviction that we ought to accept those beliefs.
So, So you said Nietzsche's aim is to undermine morality. So that does that mean that we shouldn't be moral? I mean, we should just, how should we live in the absence of morality? I just want to know a little bit more about what the morality is that he's trying to undermine. And once it's undermined, what's supposed to be left? Just anything goes? I mean, what's the story here?
Well, those are the big questions that Nietzsche's work sets us. Let's take the first part of that. That is, what's he trying to undermine? And he describes the target a lot of different ways. He often speaks about Christian morality, what we would now call Judeo-Christian morality, the famous morality of the Judeo-Christians. He sometimes talks about philosophical views about morality, Kant's utilitarianism, and so on. I think we can think of him as aiming at a set of moral views that he captures with this idea of the ascetic ideal, that is, an ascetic morality, a morality that, in his view, condemns suffering, thinks that suffering must be alleviated, that condemns selfishness and self-interestedness, that's hostile to inequality. It's basically an egalitarian morality that's hostile to instinctual gratification, sexual gratification being paramount among that.
So he thinks if you believe in equality, if you think suffering is bad and you should have sympathy for all beings and try to alleviate their suffering, you're somehow making some terrible mistake. Is that how I should understand what you're saying?
Well, I'm not sure we would think we ought to say that he thinks you're making a mistake, because that would assume, and this goes back to the earlier question raised about whether he's a moral skeptic. He is a kind of moral skeptic in the sense that I think he doesn't think any of these moral judgments are objectively true or false. And I think he thinks that about his own moral judgments as well, something we can come back to if the conversation leads us there.
Okay. Let me ask this question, Brian. There is a, I don't know whether it's a popular picture of Nietzsche, where this whole idea of a Superman is very important. And I know Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, the idea that the really exceptional person shouldn't be bound by moral principles. A lot of people find this pretty disturbing and not very attractive. That doesn't sound like it was a central Nietzschean point from what you've told us.
Yeah, not in the form in which it's become popularized. I mean, it's one of the unfortunate things about the popular reception of Nietzsche that everybody immediately associates him with the Übermensch, the Superman, or the Overman. In fact, the character of the Übermensch appears centrally in only one of Nietzsche's books, though it's one of his most famous, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. But in every book he wrote subsequent to that, including his genealogy, Beyond Good and Evil, and many other famous works, he never mentions that idea again. It simply drops out of the corpus.
But doesn't he mention, I mean, he mentions the noble spirits and all that stuff time and time again, and the person of the higher qualities who shouldn't be taken in and governed by this herd morality that's trying to bring him down, kind of thing.
And that's absolutely right. I think there's no question, and this brings us back to the question, what's wrong with that morality that we were just talking about? What I take it Nietzsche thinks is wrong with that morality is that that kind of morality is incompatible with a certain kind of human flourishing that would be available to the highest types of human beings, as he calls them. But the highest types of human beings aren't Nietzsche's Superman. In fact, if you look at Nietzsche's corpus, his favorite example, again and again and again, is the great German writer Goethe. Yeah. His second favorite example is Nietzsche.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like when we started the show with this theme from 2001, that's really was maybe a little misleading. It was Thus Spake Zarathustra. But maybe that's not as central as we thought. We'll come back to this. But first, I think we're going to take a break.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break. We'd like you to join us. You can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the comments link up at the right-hand corner there, and we'll read your question on the air. This is Philosophy Talk. We'll be right back.
I'm sure all you Nietzscheans out there will recognize R.E.M. from their album Life's Rich Pageant, I Am Superman. Actually, I am John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Brian Leiter, professor of law and philosophy from the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about Nietzsche's views about the origin of morality. We'd like you to join our conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment via email.
Here's some questions for you to ponder. Where does morality really come from? Is it just a confidence game imposed by the weak on the strong? Or are Nietzsche's views wrong-headed, morally repugnant, and best forgotten?
Yeah. So, Brian, I'm going to talk more about this supposed destructiveness of morality. I mean, I think of morality as a thing that enables people to live together and therefore have common flourishing. Tell me more about why Nietzsche thought that, as it were, the herd morality, as he liked to dismissively call it, was so destructive to the higher types.
Yeah. Well, I think that is the crucial thing to emphasize, that Nietzsche is worried about the effects of morality on certain people. He's not necessarily seeking, at least not in my view, a sort of general moral revolution in society, society as a whole. I take it what he's worried about is that somebody couldn't be Goethe, somebody couldn't be Beethoven, somebody couldn't be Nietzsche if they structured their life around a set of moral imperatives about altruism, always do for others. If they viewed happiness, as utilitarians do, as the highest goal. Nietzsche's thought is that to be a great creative genius, and that is, I think, ultimately clearly his favorite example of the sort of higher human beings he's interested in, to be that kind of person, you can't be a hedonist, and you also can't be an altruist. And we could go on and on with other examples.
That sounds pretty plausible, and maybe to have the Goethes and Nietzsche's, it's worth having that insight. But sometimes he talks more like he's talking about the aristocrats versus the masses. I think somewhere he says, maybe in Beyond Good and Evil, the notion of equality and of taking another person's interests as equal to your own, that applies among the aristocrats. It was never intended to apply between them and the rest of us, riffraff.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't quite say it wasn't intended to apply, but he certainly makes the historical point. And this is, in a way, the subject of the first essay of Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morality. He makes the historical point that that moralities can be traced back to their origins in certain sorts of social classes. So that what he calls master morality really did trace, he thinks, to the ruling classes in the case of the genealogy, the Roman Empire, though he's concerned with the periods before that as well.
So it's more of a genealogical point than his advocacy that the aristocrats should still behave that way.
No, I don't think it's just a genealogical point, but, I'm going to let some callers in here. We've
Now, are these aristocrats or riffraff?
We'll see. Bishara in Berkeley. Did I get that right, Bishara?
Yeah, you got it right. Thank you for allowing me to come on board. This is interesting because this is exactly what I wanted to ask. I'm writing a small article, and I wanted to ask, what is the relationship between self and, if you want to say, community, meaning self and the rest of humanity? Morally speaking.
Do you mean for Nietzsche, or just do you want one true answer to that?
In general, I know that I came into the program and you guys are discussing Nietzsche, but I think somebody must have some sort of opinion, at least from the collective reading. When does self take precedence when does community take precedence? And also, based on the issue that you guys were talking about in terms of the class.
Okay, thanks, Bishara. Brian, Bishara raises, I think, an interesting question. I've actually always wondered about this in Nietzsche. I mean, what view can he have about how these aristocrats, how these noble spirits, are supposed to fit in with the rest of us? I mean, what's the theory of community, of communal life in Nietzsche?
Well, I'll tell you what my view about this is, that Nietzsche doesn't have one. That Nietzsche, the best way to think about Nietzsche is what you might call an esoteric moralist. He's got a certain message that he wants certain people to get, and he wants to affect the transformation of their consciousness, how they think about morality. But his aim is not, as it were, a general transformation of society as a whole. Now, this, of course, runs against certain people who want to treat Nietzsche as having a radically inegalitarian political philosophy. It seems to me that reads way too much into relatively little that Nietzsche says on these topics. He's just not interested in the community as a whole, and that, as it were, is a fact about him.
That's strange. We have callers from all over the country here, actually. Robert in Detroit, Michigan is on the line. Robert, well, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Ken. I think in discussing Nietzsche, it's always important to keep in mind what Sartre said. He's no philosopher. He was trained as a philologist. And I want to know why Professor Leiter doesn't think he's committing a genetic fallacy the way he criticizes Judeo-Christian morality. I mean, someone could accept the psychological account, say, yeah, there's a little bit of resentment there at the core, but, I mean, this doesn't invalidate any of those systems.
Maybe we better make sure the listeners are up to date on what the genetic fallacy is. Why don't you explain it, Ken?
Why don't you explain it, Brian, since you're being accused of it.
Okay.
Right. Well, I'm not. Only Nietzsche is, right? The genetic fallacy, and Nietzsche was well aware of it and was very careful to say he was avoiding it. The genetic fallacy is the thought that you've shown something about the truth of a belief by showing us something about its origin. And Nietzsche is very keen to say that the origin of a belief is one thing, its truth or value is another. And that, of course, then raises the question, why did he write A History or Genealogy of Morality? And I take it you could think of it this way, in very simple terms, which is that if you learn that your beliefs were arrived at the wrong kind of way, that ought to make you suspicious about them, right? If it turns out that I recommend a particular restaurant to you, and then it turns out I'm part owner of the restaurant, that raises a question about whether my recommendation of the great food at this restaurant is really credible. And I take it that's what Nietzsche's after. He wants to say, look where morality came from. And where it came from isn't so wonderful. Maybe you ought to rethink your commitment to it. But that leaves open the question whether it's really true, whether we ought to accept it, and so on.
Okay, I think that's a nice response. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Brian Leiter from the University of Texas at Austin, author of Morality on Nietzsche. John, you wanted to respond, I think.
I agree with Brian's question, Brian's answer to the astute question. I think in general, although the genetic fallacy is a fallacy, that still the genesis of an idea can sometimes be illuminating. It's not the fact that an idea has a kind of a funny psychological or even psychoanalytic or even nutty origin doesn't mean that it's false, but it may help us to understand the idea better and may help us to understand what some other good argument against it might be.
Well, that's right, but, you know, there is this distinction between how you come across an idea or a thought and how you confirm it or disconfirm it. I mean, Copernicus, you know, couldn't stand to see that the sun was not at the center of things because he was some kind of sun worship or something. But that doesn't make the thought that he had that the earth goes around the sun false.
But if you think the origin of your view is that it came pretty directly from God by way of the Bible or a priest.
That's true.
Then somebody says, no, actually, it's just a herd morality idea that was a response to the situations in the Roman Empire. That can affect your view of its validity.
We have lots of callers, again, from all around the country. Arpan in Austin, Texas, from where you hail, Brian. Welcome, Arpan, to Philosophy Talk.
Good afternoon, Dr. Leiter.
Good afternoon.
Sir, in Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche remarks that there are no moral phenomena, but there are only moral interpretations of phenomena. Could you explain what role interpretation plays in Nietzsche's view of normative theory?
Thanks, Arvin. I think this is one of your fans or something.
Yeah, let's make sure, Brian, you explain normative theory on your way to answering this.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, that, of course, is a big question. when Nietzsche says that there are no moral phenomena, there are no moral facts, there are just moral interpretations, what he means specifically in context of that remark, but it illustrates the point more generally, he means that people interpret the behavior of other human beings as though it makes sense to view them as morally responsible for what they do, because they have free will. In fact, Nietzsche thinks people don't have free will. People aren't free enough such that they can be responsible for their actions. Therefore, to interpret them as morally responsible is to impose an interpretation that the facts of the case don't warrant.
Yeah.
And that's often the way Nietzsche looks at things. He says, on the one hand, there's a correct naturalistic explanation for what's going on, what human behavior is really like, what its sources are. And then on the other hand, there are these moral and religious interpretations we impose upon the natural phenomena which misdescribe it.
So we're getting some really interesting phone calls here. Our number is 415-841-4134. Brian, I want to just go back to the theme of the Goethes and the Supermen and so forth. Now, you're in a philosophy department that's no doubt a bunch of really nice men and women that never have a harsh word for each other. But many of us in philosophy occasionally meet, or maybe I should say the humanities, maybe I should say in academia, occasionally
maybe
meet
in life.
Yeah, well, maybe not, but occasionally meet self-satisfied, self-important, pompous twits who kind of think that they should be treated as Nietzschean supermen. Somebody else should clean up after them. Someone else should do their Xeroxing and so forth and so on. Now, how does one of us who feels like that, what test can we have to know whether we really are a Goethe that ought to break the rules or just another slob that ought to pay attention to him?
Now, this is really a question for applied Nietzsche's moral
Absolutely.
Philosophy, which is an undeveloped discipline.
Well, we're developing right here.
Yeah.
Nietzsche has an answer, right? Nietzsche's answer is, can you will the eternal return? Right? This is one of Nietzsche's, again, very famous doctrines. It's actually one that was important to him. Right? Nietzsche says, can you live in such a way that you would be willing to have your life repeated over and over again, exactly in every detail? And if you're living in such a way that you'd be willing, that you could tolerate the thought of having the whole thing occur again and again and again, then you are living the life of Nietzsche's higher human being.
But that's not a very good test, because if I'm a schmuck, to put it in crude terms, I could, and I, you know, I lord it over everybody and they all resent me and hate me, but I think, wow, this is pretty cool. I could will it over and over again, but nobody else would will it over and over again. I mean, what's that the test of? That's just a test of my self-satisfaction.
That's whether you're a schmuck or a schlamozzle, as it was explained to me, but I probably got the pronunciation wrong.
I don't quite see what that would be a test of, Brian. Right.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right that it couldn't be the sole criterion, though Nietzsche often talks as though it's the most distinctive one. I suppose we'd have to question whether our self-satisfied schlemiel, as you put it, really could be so self-satisfied that they could bear the thought of the eternal return. I think the reality, of course, is that self-satisfied schlemiels are often self-satisfied on the surface and deeply worried underneath the surface.
Yeah,
but that's a question. This is armchair psychology, and I probably can't do much better than that.
Okay. Rigoletto in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rigoletto.
Hi, good afternoon. I have an observation to make concerning your earlier remarks about suffering. Pardon me, I got a cold.
Are you on a cell phone?
No, I'm not. But
your connection is a little bad, so please
speak
up.
But you are suffering with a cold, so it's a very, very appropriate question.
I read him many years ago that he meant by suffering that being in the company of people who suffered, whether from illness or for other reasons, could corrupt an aristocratic personality. But I have another question as well. If you want to respond to that, that's fine. But my other question was kind of in two parts. Is it true that one or more of his texts, as published, were possibly corrupted or altered by his sister? And secondly, what translation is considered the better one in English? I'll take an answer on the air. Thank you.
Okay. You've asked three questions there. Brian, you want to respond quickly to those three questions?
Sure. On the first point, it's certainly true that Nietzsche thinks that pity for the suffering can be damaging. Why he thinks that is a complex psychological story we probably shouldn't go into. But he also thinks that suffering itself is a good thing. If you read his autobiography, he has nothing but gratitude for how much he himself suffered. He had terrible physical health problems throughout his life, and he thought it was an enormous stimulus to his own creativity. On the question of Nietzsche's text, there's a well-known book called The Will to Power, which was compiled after his mental breakdown by his sister and a friend. It is a non-book, as people often say, that it isn't a book he intended to write. He didn't intend to write a book called The Will to Power. It simply collects material that was in his notebooks.
And I understand that's where the charge of anti-Semitism and all that stuff gets going, right, from the Nazi reading of that text or something? Am I right about that?
It's not. That text certainly played a role. There's a more complex story. His sister took control of his estate. His sister was a proto-Nazi and anti-Semite. She issued very selective editions of all his works to emphasize themes sympathetic to German nationalism. She had to purge, for example, all the stuff where Nietzsche disparages Germans, because the one group of people that Nietzsche really hated were Germans.
Yeah,
so all of that
right.
had to get cut out of the corpus.
We have Brian, we have callers calling in from all over the country, and I want to give them a chance to get in here. We have
sure.
Aaron from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, on the line. Aaron, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, thank you for Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
I have a question. Like Nietzsche describes in, I believe it's in the Genealogy of Morals, about the revolt of slave morality as describing the rise of the Judeo-Christian ethic. I'm wondering, was there not, or perhaps it was very subtle, was there a slave morality in the American history of slavery? And when they were emancipated, did it come to the surface and become sort of a master morality as a result?
Thanks, Aaron. I'm not sure, Brian, but I take it slave morality in Nietzsche is the morality of sort of democratic egalitarianism. Am I not right about that?
Well, I think he thinks the morality of democratic egalitarianism arises out of a morality that in the first instance was genuinely a morality of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And he's referring to a simple historical fact, namely that Christianity first took hold in the oppressed classes of the Roman Empire. But I also think it's very important for Nietzsche to then see that that morality severs its tie with a particular social class, so that once slave morality triumphs, we find lots of middle and upper middle class folks like you and me subscribing to slave morality as well.
And we should say historically that Christianity played a very complicated role in American slavery. On the one hand, it probably did have the function to a certain extent of making people accommodate with suffering and not protest. But on the other hand, there was definitely a cohesive foundations of protest movement that's owed to the church. Brian, I wanted to just briefly get back to the good question about what people should read, what editions. Now, I was brought up on Walter Kaufmann's translations and the Modern Library selection. Is that still a good place to start?
Kaufmann's translations are certainly a very good place to start. Kaufmann is gifted at capturing the flavor of Nietzsche's German in English. Scholars will sometimes complain that he takes liberties with some of the German, but I think for the general reader, Kaufmann's translations are the best place to start. More recently, Cambridge University Press has been publishing new translations, which are pretty uniformly of high quality.
Oh, coming up soon, we'll talk about some of Nietzsche's inspirations, in particular his Arthur Schopenhauer, who I guess John and he need to share a love, both as teenagers. You both loved Schopenhauer, is that right?
Yes, I gather that he loved Schopenhauer as a teenager because some of his early writings say nice things about Schopenhauer. I like Schopenhauer because he's such a grouch. He hated women, he hated men, he hated students, he hated professors. He was just grouchy about everything, and for some reason when I was a teenager, that really fit my mood. Now, of course, I'm just kind of a happy-go-lucky, loves-everybody kind of guy.
Yeah, right.
But we're going to hear something about Schopenhauer, aren't we, Ken?
Yeah, from Ian Scholz, our 60-Second Philosophers. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
soul sensation, Jerry Butler, and Only the Strong Survive. My partner, Ken Taylor, is kind of a soul sensation, a soul phenomenon in his own right.
You got that, John.
I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. So I'm getting quite an earful here about Nietzsche, morality, Superman, and the like. Let's dig a little bit deeper. Let's look at the background a little bit.
Today, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, tells us about Schopenhauer, who was a big influence on Nietzsche.
Prepare yourself. Ready, go!
Ian Scholes, Immanuel Kant posited an unknowable reality behind our observed reality. Arthur Schopenhauer, born 1788, died 1860, claimed to know that unknowable reality. It is the will. The human will rules the intellect, tormenting us with our own desires. We do not live life for the pleasure of it, but because the will to live is irresistible, instinctive, and irrational. This philosophy appealed greatly to two of his later fans, Friedrich Nietzsche and Richard Wagner. Schopenhauer, as a young man, was apprenticed to German merchants, expected to take over his father's business. Then his father died, apparently a suicide, in 1807, and the inheritance made it possible for Schopenhauer to pursue the life of the mind. He was the first Western philosopher to incorporate Eastern thought. His themes involved real life, not abstract philosophical puzzles, and unlike previous philosophies, Schopenhauer's revealed a deep pessimism. In Schopenhauer's time, unfortunately for him, readers preferred Hegel, his colleague at Heidelberg University. Schopenhauer hated Hegel, whether for his philosophy or his popularity is not clear. He did write, however, quote, "If I were to say that the so-called philosophy of this fellow Hegel is a pseudo-philosophy, paralyzing all mental powers, stifling all real thinking, and by the most outrageous misuse of language putting in its place the hollowest, most senseless, thoughtless, most stupefying verbiage, I should be quite right," unquote. Unlike many philosophers, Schopenhauer wrote in a direct manner and was often quite funny, especially when he was being nasty. And he was a nasty man, vain, antisocial, curmudgeonly, and misogynist. Read his essay on women, if you dare. He considered 5/6 of all humanity worth only contempt. The story goes that he pushed an old woman down a flight of stairs because her chatting with a friend irritated him. She broke a leg, and he was forced to provide her pension for the remainder of her life. When she died, the story continues, he replied to the letter giving him the news, "Obit unus abit. She dies, the burden departs." In later life, he found fame, but it did not dent his bitter self-regard. After a heart attack, he told a friend, quote, "If at times I thought myself unfortunate, it is because of a confusion and error. I have mistaken myself for someone else. Who am I really? I am the author of the world as will and representation. I am the one who has given an answer to the mystery of being that will occupy the thinkers of future centuries. That is what I am, and who can dispute it in the years of life that still remain for me," unquote. He died soon after. Schopenhauer had a major influence not only on Nietzsche, but Wittgenstein, Jung, Freud, Einstein, Thomas Mann, and Adolf Hitler. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher describing the life of Arthur Schopenhauer, a major influence on the man of the hour here on Philosophy Talk, Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Brian Leiter from the University of Texas at Austin. John, I gotta tell you, one of my favorite lines from Nietzsche is his refutation. In the end, you know, he rejected Schopenhauer's pessimism. And here's how he does it. I love this line. He says, "Schopenhauer was such a pessimist, but he played the flute every day after dinner. He stops before morality or something like that, but he played the flute." Now, how's that for a refutation?
I think it's just a wonderful refutation. You know, it's probably one of the most valid arguments Nietzsche ever came up with. Whoops, I better be careful. We got Brian Leiter on the line.
Yes, indeed. So, Brian, I had a thought about this herd morality thing. You know, Nietzsche criticizes it, but it seems to me you got these artistes around of themselves, these superior noble people. If I'm one of the herd, I think herd morality is a darn good thing. How else am I to keep these folks in check? So, I mean, it's not. I mean, it seems to me he's just pointing out a fact, and from the herd's perspective, a darn good fact about their morality. How do you?
Well. My response is, in fact, I think that's exactly how Nietzsche looks at it, which is one of the reasons I said before I don't think he anticipates a general moral revolution in society. One of the lines he uses, he says, "Herd morality for the herd, but let it not reach out beyond." And if that, in fact, is his attitude, the explanation might be exactly the one you gave.
Yeah, so maybe the picture we get, I don't, tell me if I'm reading this right, maybe the picture we get is of, I mean, human life is going to be constant struggle. There'll be the herd, there'll be the nobles, as it were, and there's never going to be a kind of modus vivendi, a kind of shared life among them, but there's always this tension. I mean, and that's life. That's the way it is.
I think to some extent that is what Nietzsche's picture is. What he's really concerned about is he thinks that in a culture that took morality very seriously, we wouldn't have any of these sort of higher individuals, right? If we wouldn't have any of these Goethes or these Nietzsches or these Beethovens, or pick your favorite example, everybody would be in the grips of the utilitarian, altruistic, selfless mindset. And there would be enormous cultural costs. And at the end of the day, Nietzsche likes high culture.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Now just hearing about Schopenhauer and being reminded of his anti-women views, how did Nietzsche stack up on that? I don't remember him discussing too many women in his books. Did he have a anti-woman bias like Schopenhauer?
It is often said, and famous passages can be adduced here and there, that Nietzsche is a misogynist. It seems to me the reality of it is a bit more complex, because it turns out that a great deal of what Nietzsche says about women involves exploiting certain 19th century stereotypes about women. For example, that they are instinctual rather than rational.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you think about Nietzsche, you realize that, in fact, he thinks that's the right valuation, that it's much better to be instinctual
right.
than to be excessively prone to ratiocination about everything. So he exploits these stereotypes. It sounds like he's being derogatory, but it clearly, in many contexts, I don't want to say all in many contexts, it's part of a subversive project. And in a way, he thinks the women have exactly the stereotypical traits of the women, as 19th century Europeans would have thought about it, are exactly the traits with the higher value.
We're getting near the bottom of the show. I'm going to take one more caller here. Anna in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anna.
Hi, John, Ken, and Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm recommending a book called Thou Shalt Not Be Aware by a psychoanalyst or former psychoanalyst named Alice Miller, a German writer, who looked into the life of Nietzsche. And I know you're going to accuse me of the genetic fallacy, but I do think that a life can illuminate the philosophy that comes out of it. And Nietzsche was, in fact, throughout his life, pretty much under the control of his mother and his sister, to the extent that, as you know, the will to power and his sister's pushing his thought into the Nazi mold. He did say some extraordinarily misogynistic things, including, you know, are you going to the women? Don't forget the whip.
So you think he may
but
have
he
had
himself
context does
had
count.
No free will in freeing himself from the women in his life.
Thanks.
Very interesting recommendation there.
Nietzsche is certainly a ripe topic for psychoanalysis. He, of course, had an enormous impact upon how Freud thought about these kinds of questions. The one factual point I would like to correct, it's certainly true that after his mental collapse, he was literally under the control of his sister and his mother. But for most of his adult life, he essentially lived on his own, traveling between different inns in northern Italy and southern France and Switzerland.
So there's one, since we're on biography a little bit, there's one thing that's always intrigued me about Nietzsche. I understand that he volunteered to fight with the Prussians in the Franco-Prussian War when he had a good job in Switzerland. Why did he do that?
I don't have a good answer to that question. I'm sure it must have had something to do with the cultural ethos of the time and a feeling of, you know, Prussian pride.
I guess he didn't really fight. I misspoke. He was an ambulance driver or something.
He was an ambulance orderly. He was, in fact, injured relatively quickly since he was never blessed with good health. The minor injury quickly knocked him out. So I think his entire military service lasted about 2 months and perhaps put a damper on his enthusiasm for military conflict.
Brian, I want to ask you one last philosophical point. To whom is this higher morality accessible? How do I know? I mean, this goes back to something John said earlier. Are people just destined to be, you know, one of the herd, or is every human born with the potential to reach something higher? So that if every human were born with the potential, then Nietzsche would be recommending to all human beings, you know, live in this noble way. I mean, what's that?
Well, I think Nietzsche is often read, especially when he's read as a precursor of the existentialists, as somebody who thinks that everybody does have this capacity to sort of transform themselves ex nihilo, out of nothing into something new. In many ways, I'm skeptical that that's actually his view. And this partly has to do with the influence of other views in the sciences at the time, which I think led Nietzsche to think that a lot more of this was predetermined from the outset. Yeah. He's what we'd call today sort of a genetic determinist.
Yeah.
But of course, that wasn't his way of conceptualizing the point. And so in that sense, the options we have to create ourselves may be much more limited than we'd ordinarily like to think.
Brian, it's been great talking to you. Before Ken gives you the official goodbye, I just want to say that your website, The Philosophical Gourmet, offers just a lot of information and some thoughtful opinion. And I personally want to thank you for it and all it does to help encourage people to study philosophy and gives them some guidelines about where and how they can do it.
So thank you. I appreciate that.
We've been talking with Brian Leiter of the University of Texas at Austin, author of Nietzsche and Morality. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you. Really.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So Bye. Long, Ryan.
So, John, are you wise? Do you learn something new about morality?
Well, I learned a lot new about Nietzsche. You know, Nietzsche I really liked as an undergraduate. And then as I became a kind of a professional philosopher in graduate school and earning tenure and writing analytical philosophy. I got sick of him, but now I'm sort of a fan again.
Yeah, we got a lot of Nietzsche scholars in our department, so we hear about this stuff a lot. This has been fun, though. John, I hear drumming.
That's not drumming, Ken. That's conundrumming. The conundrumming announces our conundrums, which we have each week at this time. Conundrums are puzzles, maybe just an intellectual puzzle or maybe something about your daily life. Ken and I will give you some philosophical advice. It probably won't help, but it may be amusing.
We have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Andrea.
Hello.
Where are you calling from, Andrea?
San Francisco.
Oh, what do you do in that lovely city?
I'm a biologist, actually.
Oh, wow.
Are you going to ask some kind of question about DNA or something?
Well, it is biology related.
Well, let's hear it. What's your conundrum?
Well, I live here in San Francisco, and it's sort of a gay mecca. There's
a
lot of gay
a little bit, yeah.
I've known quite a few gay people, and the question comes up, why are people gay? How does that come about? And I've tried to argue that could be a choice, but gay people seem to say, no, well, it's not a choice because I wouldn't choose it because, you know, society's hard on gay people. That whether there's a genetic component or not, choice should sort of supersede biology. I just wonder if I should just shut up about the whole argument.
Let me ask you a question. Do you choose to be heterosexual?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, if I woke up one morning and I just had this urge to be with a woman, I feel like part of me would just, like, fight it. I would be like, no, I have this other lifestyle I'm living, and, you know, it's been good to me so far. Why go there?
That's true. You can often override your urges. You can often war against your urges or your desires or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think many times gay people find themselves doing just that for a long time, and then finally giving up that fight because they recognize there's something authentic and real and deep about their gayness. So that you can fight against it doesn't make it a choice.
Looks to me pretty genetic because some of these people they don't want to be gay. They're embarrassed by it. They don't want to talk to their parents about it. It's hard to imagine what it would be except just innate preference.
So my philosophical advice to you, I don't know if John would agree, is that you wondered if you should shut up about this. I don't think you should shut up about anything, but I don't think you should be so confident that you know what's going on. I think it's a deep puzzle, a deep question.
How do you feel about tomatoes, Andrea?
Well, I remember my parents telling me to eat stuff I didn't like, and I just would say, you can't make me. So.
Right. Well, so even then, you didn't take the cop out I did and say, Dad, I've got this terrible allergy to tomatoes. You just said, it's my choice, bug off.
Yeah, that's true. Okay,
but not everybody's like that. So you got to appreciate that about people.
Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Surely there must be some perplexing issue in your life that a little philosophical examination might help. If you have a challenging conundrum, it's easy to reach us.
Just head over to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the button at the top right called Conundrums. Once again, that's www.philosophytalk.org. We'd love to hear from you, especially with a conundrum. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And various groups at Stanford, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, members of KLW Information Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University, or of our funders, or of anybody else, for that matter.
The conversation can continue on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Just go there and click on the forums button. Next week, we'll ask the question, has science replaced religion? Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.